Welcome to A Better Way with Crossroads Bible Church. In our third season, we are answering questions you submitted to us during our What Does the Bible Say About sermon series. Each episode will tackle a wide variety of topics from theology to current events. And now, your host, Charlie Ridenour.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is episode 2 of our third season on the CBC podcast, A Better Way. And it's a continuation of our sermon series, What the Bible Says About, where you people sent in the questions. And we quickly realized we could not handle them all on Sunday morning. So this is what's left over. And I'm joined again by Dylan.
Hi there.
And Britt.
Hello.
So last week we talked gender and family stuff, and this week the conversation gets no easier with politics and cultural issues. Who's excited?
Oh boy.
Well, actually, you know, when politics come up at my house, I usually immediately get up and walk out of the room.
Do you really?
I do. So, I hate this conversation.
My parents are very kind, and my dad is very compassionate, and he'll have his, you know, when I drive their car sometimes. I will change the radio station. So he's, you know, kind of like conservative, Fox News guy, listens to WBAP, and I'll just set it on like NPR. So when he turns the car on next time, it's on. Just knowing that it's going to rile him up. That's my family. We dive in head first because we are non-conflict avoiders, everybody. It's great. So hopefully that's not what this conversation is about, because I think we made it pretty apparent that Democrat and Republican are both welcome in the kingdom of God. That the gospel has in it principles of both, that Democrat and Republican isn't a metric or value of good, but it's how we contribute to the good of the society by caring for one another. So basically, you know, we said it in the sermon when we talked about this, that if your God is always espousing the political stances of your political party, then your political party is probably your God. And just how do we have a conversation in such a divided world about politics? And remember that we're not united by our political position or stance, but by Jesus, who's bigger than all those things. So we talked a lot about it in the sermon, and we're just going to dive in. And a real quick note before we do, there are several of the questions today that are really policy issues. So we'll do our best and we'll give some suggestions, but sometimes the Bible doesn't speak to specific policy issues of America, because that's not why it was written. So keep an open mind in this, and we'll get there in a sec. But the first question we have is, what does the Bible say about your relationship, about our relationship, I should say, with the church and the world?
When I think about this question, it does make me think about the command of Jesus that we're to love God and love others, right? And so what is our relationship? It's to love the church, it's to love the people of the world, and the church is meant to do that in order to follow that command of Jesus to love one another.
Yeah.
But as we do that, it gets complicated, right? It takes a lot of effort to and wisdom and conversation to figure out how to do that best.
Yeah.
And so there's different takes that people have. There's different ways that you might want to address a particular situation. But our mindset in this is always one of love.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's got to go before any of the answers to these questions, or specifically how the church engages with the world. Yeah. And I'm assuming the question, you know, like I said last time, we have to interpret the questions. So I'm assuming when they say world there, they mean kind of like, you know, the conflicting nature of the world that goes against the ways of Jesus. You know, I think part of the answer to this question is to recognize the relationship between the two and how they've shifted. So over the history of the church, we've had shifts in our engagement level. You know, at first you engaged with the world because you kind of had to. And then it moved to where the church became the staple for the world's system of belief after Constantine. And that got a little too fast, too quickly, and power was abused. And for a little while in between all of that, there was a group of people that wanted to protect the ways of the church. So they completely withdrew in the monastic system, right? And so you've had kind of the litmus, or the, what should I say, you've got a vast array of the church's response to the world. And I mentioned a book in the sermon, Christ and Culture, and they kind of lay out 5 or 6 different positions. And I'm a fan of the last one, which is simply that, man, we have to remember that the world needs the church, because the church tells people what God's good is and how good he is to us. And so when we talk about what's the relationship, we cannot fully assimilate with the world, but we cannot fully disengage with the world either. It's this place that I believe Adam's job in Genesis 1 was to subdue the world and to point people, everything in the world, all created good, towards God's goodness. So I think what's our relationship? We got to engage it. We got to engage it with wisdom, and we got to engage it with love, and we got to engage it with justice, but we have to engage the world because the world needs Jesus, and that comes from the church. And we got to break away from the idea of our holy huddles just to protect ourselves. Our gospel was never meant to be safe. And we've fallen into this kind of idols, if you will, of our culture and our Christian culture. And we really value safety and security and comfort. And maybe the church in the West has to ask questions about how we value comfort and safety over the call to be a church that the world desperately needs so that they see Jesus. But now I'm preaching, and this is supposed to be a conversation. So I think we got to engage. I think we got to engage more. I think we got to tear down walls and meet people where they're at, because that's what Jesus did for us. I mean, all those things. So
I've been reading Rich Velotis's new book that's just released recently called Good and Beautiful and Kind. Mm-hmm. And he talks in there. It's so beautiful. It's the whole book is about this question about how we engage with our culture and how we grow in kindness and compassion towards people who we disagree with. And one of the things that he mentioned in there, you were mentioning the monastic movement. And he talked about it in a way that I hadn't heard anybody say before. He was talking about, like, it was actually after Constantine stopped all the persecution that that Christians were now had a different relationship with culture. Mm-hmm. And that's what actually drove them.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Out into the desert. Like, mm-hmm. they needed to find Christ in a new and fresh way.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because I'm hearing other people talk about a new monastic movement and how our culture is driving us. Mm-hmm. And so I just would like to think about the idea that, like, as we're talking about how to engage with the culture, realize that the culture is pushing us even in our relationship with Christ. It is making us not want to be complacent with where we are.
Yeah.
And so I think, in a weird way, I think we should be grateful and thankful, even if it's uncomfortable and kind and we're having to deal with problems.
Yeah.
Like, this is actually doing a good thing in us.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
And one thing I would add is just that our relationship with the world is not a static, fixed thing.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be different times when we're going to be more or less able to engage. And also, we, as members of the church, are gifted in different ways. And so some of us are called to more engaged presence and maybe less engaged presence based on our gifting and what we're able to do and what we're focusing on. And so I just think that, you know, it's not a fixed thing. It's something that could be changing at any time.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that it's an interesting question because it just goes back to that tension between how engaged are we and how much are we changing the world? The world's changing us. You know, you guys, I mean, the whole staff knows that I really don't like Christian music, right? When people, you know, when people like bring up Christian artists, I'm like, I don't know who that is. And it's not that I don't like worship music. And let me, if you know why I don't like Christian music, it's because of the book, Christ and Culture, is I think our job is to redeem culture. And so when we create these separate spaces where only Christians come together, I think one, we're failing at our job. And two, I'm a big believer of saying, hey, if you want to be a Christian, make music, make the best music you can. You don't need to create your own genre for it where, you know, you're at the top of it. So, like, if you're an artist that's a Christian, be an artist that's a Christian and do a really good job of that. And then when people say, why is your art so good? Or why is your music so good? Because God created music and it's all meant to glorify him. So it's kind of that idea that I really like muddying those waters a lot. And Bridget, you said, at some point in time, we need different things. The monastic movement was really good for Christianity. It held on to some principles that had been forgotten when culture kind of became the champion for Christianity and made some unhealthy rhythms and ways. So seeing the beauty of both those things is important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next question. What does the Bible say about our obligation to care for orphans?
So if you look at the Old Testament, back at the beginning, when God is giving kind of what his vision for the people of Israel are going to be like, one of the commands that's always stood out with me, talking about a tithe, it says at the end of, in Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 28 and 29, at the end of every 3 years, you must bring all the tithe of your produce in that very year, and you must store it up in your villages. Then the Levites, the resident foreigners, the orphans, and the widows of your villages may come and eat their fill. There's this obligation that there are people kind of on the fringes. And one of those that is normally especially mentioned is the orphans, the fatherless, right, as people that the community are supposed to take care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. To James 1:27, a religion that is pure and undefiled before God, the Father, is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction and to keep oneselves unstained from the world. That comes from a place where I think I'm going to, you know, I didn't take a whole lot of art history classes at the Moody Bible Institute, but Brett, you might know this. There was a shift artistically, I want to say it's around like the 1300s, when we started elevating babies. Like the way we painted them was different and the way we valued them was different. But for the most part, especially in the first century world, they didn't elevate babies. Babies were kind of a nuisance, and I mean, you've heard us talk about it. As a father in the Roman culture that held on to power and could do whatever he wanted with his family, if you had a baby you didn't want, or a baby that was in any way deformed, or a baby that was even a female in some respects, you would just leave it on the doorstep, and it would either be taken or die of exposure. And so when the call of the gospel in the first century is to care for these widows and orphans, it's this idea that we're supposed to radically change how we see the least of these we talked about before. And so it profoundly shaped what the first century church was. It profoundly shaped who they were supposed to care for. It profoundly shaped the power dynamic between the church and the rest of the world that didn't care for these things, that didn't care for babies. And so now we live in a world where, you know, we fight for babies, but it wasn't always the case in church history. And I'm glad the early church did. That's what they were known for. And you can even see evidences of that today. So Christians adopt more kids. I think I want to say it's like 1.8 or 2.3 times as much as non-Christian people. Like the church still does a pretty great job societally of saying, I want to take care of widows and orphans, which is good to see. It's good to hear. It's how God designed it.
Yeah. When we talk about going back to the first century, the way the early church was responding to this, when you had babies that were set out to be exposed, a common thing was for slavers to come pick them up.
Yeah.
But Christians would also take them and Christians would adopt them. And it actually became enough of a problem that they found a papyrus that was referencing this law that had been implemented where, so many babies that were left at the trash heap were being adopted that it was messing with like adoption laws. So they made it illegal to adopt more than a certain number of children. And because Christians were doing it so much, they needed to put a cap on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the love that the early church was having for these orphans, as opposed to the culture that was disposing of so many of them. And so like, I think just the love of the early church should affect, you know, the way we see it today.
Yeah.
We are supposed to care for orphans. We're supposed to find those children that are rejected and bring them in. I was actually at an academic conference where this professor was talking about how the concept of adoption in the ancient world was very different than what we think of it as. You adopt a kid to establish like legitimacy or prestige for your family. So an old person would adopt a kid to say like, I'm claiming this successful, healthy, awesome guy as my kid. You would never do that with like a little kid because they haven't lived their life yet. There's no prestige to be added.
Haven't proven themselves yet.
They haven't proven themselves yet.
But so it's more like a draft at that point, not adoption.
Right. But the Paul uses the idea that God is adopting us, and that's like crazy radical to them because he's adopting us even though we don't add anything to him.
Yeah.
And it's actually because of that concept of God adopting the unworthy that you get this shift where adoption is not necessarily just for adults that make you seem better, but it's actually going and getting kids and caring for them for their own sake.
Yeah.
So it's like Christians changed what adoption actually was.
Yeah. I mean, it all goes back to the idea of the concept of Imago Dei and that there's intrinsic value to life because God gives life.
Yeah.
And so what does the Bible say about our obligations to care for orphans? Do it.
I think one of the practical things for us here at CBC is we have quite a few families here who are adopting or fostering.
Yeah.
Like, and if you're not going to be in that boat of, you're not, you know, in a life stage where you're going to be taking on a little one, hey, there are families here in our church who you could come alongside and say, hey, how can I help you? Is there something I can provide for you? Is there, you know, how can I support you?
And we don't have a lot of programs right now in-house that we do that with. But I think that's a good point is we're not saying everybody should adopt a kid right now. It's not necessarily the solution. I do think that the question is, how can I support this effort ongoing by others? And I think find somebody that is and just ask a question. It could be as simple as I could use a home cooked meal. It could be as difficult as, you know, I know one of the issues that we've dealt with is especially if you foster, to find a babysitter is really difficult because you have to be trained in some really specific ways. So it might be, hey, I'm going to get all trained up so I can babysit for these people that can never have a night to themselves. So just a couple options. But yeah, find somebody, ask somebody. But we're called to care for them and to care for those who care for them.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, go read Matthew 25 when Jesus says, I'm the least of these, kind of sudden moment. Next question that we got. Broaden this question out a little bit, but what does the Bible say about our current immigration situation? So I think it's a nuanced conversation, and this is what I meant at the beginning when I said that the Bible doesn't speak to specific policy that we're dealing with our current political and cultural climate. And so I will say that nowhere in the scripture do we see, specifically the New Testament, do we see the Bible try and institute or regulate political policy, especially around immigration. So it gets tough and it gets a little tricky because you got to read the ethical standards that Paul sets for new believers and then translate that into policy. And here's what I know is that on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, I think we want to care for people. I think we want to care for widows and orphans. I think we want to care for third world people that want to come into the country that can't. I think we want to care. The question is not, does one side hate immigrants and does the other love it? The question is, how are we caring for people best? And if I engage the conversation with that lens to begin, it gives me a lot more compassion and grace over the other side's answers. Whether it's close down the borders or open them wide up, I think we're trying to care for people. That's really important to keep in mind. But I would say that when we talk about the immigration situation here, we need to know that the Bible does not outline a 14-point plan to help the immigration crisis at the southern border. It does, though, as far as I read the scripture, it does still call the church, the people of the church, to care for immigrants. You know, in the Old Testament, when they were really, really collective in culture and being an Israelite was a big deal, it says in the scriptures, like, if immigrants come to your country, treat them like a resident. And so it calls them to have compassion on these people that are out of their land. But I'd be curious to know you guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah, just like with orphans, with widows, with immigrants, there are people who are just in a position not to be able to take care of themselves as well because they're in maybe a place they don't belong or they're not able to inherit property, like we were talking about last week with women sometimes couldn't own property. The Bible goes out of its way to make sure we know that God cares for those people that are on the margins. He cares for the people that are more vulnerable, and he requires the people who are stronger to take care of the weak, the people who are more comfortable to take care of the uncomfortable. And so if there's an immigrant that's here, we are called to be people that make them feel like they can belong here and to take care of them if they have needs. And again, that gets to the policy of when we do this en masse in a systematic way, like, different aspects of wisdom might lean us towards one policy or another, and the Bible doesn't prescribe that, but it does say that you're to try to help.
Yeah, and I think we got to be careful as a church, and we have that balance between how's the church different from political party, of letting our political desire drown out our call for compassion, drown out our call for inclusion in a way that's healthy, that says we care for you, that hopefully they see that God cares for them. And so those are two kind of different conversations, but I go back here to what is our call as individual Christians? Yeah, you know, I have a buddy of mine who has a church in Dallas, and when about a year ago, I remember we had all the Afghan refugees kind of get displaced all over, and his church, because Dallas got a bunch of refugees around where his church was, his church took as many as they could in and provided for them and cared for them and fed them and let them live in their houses. I mean, it's what the early church is supposed to do, is necessarily not be as concerned on an individual church level with the political policy at a governmental or you know, a national level, and say, in the middle of that, which we can vote for and we can try and change and we have debate about, in the middle of that, I'm called to love the immigrant. And what does that look like in my current context?
I think one of the ways that, like I was just saying before, one of the ways that you can get involved at Crossroads is, you know, our missions department regularly supports international student dinners and stuff, and want looks for people to help connect with, hey, these are foreigners in our land. Like, that's an excellent way for you if you're thinking, but I don't know any immigrants.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we really do have some at colleges, like in Denton.
Yeah, we do.
It's really close by. And I know that our missions department would love to get you connected to a student.
Yeah.
Have them over for dinner.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think that you said that was really important, I just kind of want to bring it back up again, was the humility needed to see the other side, the other political party. Like, they do want, I think all of us do indeed want to know how to help people. You know, one side might be afraid of opening the borders for, we can't help people if we have too many people to help.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
And the other side is, let's, you know, it's out of a kindness and a desire to help everyone,
yep.
Right? Like, I think our biggest thing is to not see enemies with the people we're standing beside.
Yeah,
because then you can't help anybody.
That's right.
When you're fighting amongst yourself.
Yeah, it's that George W. Bush quote that I use often, which is, we like to see ourselves through our best intentions and our enemies as our worst examples.
Right.
So that's what we carry into this conversation. and doesn't help the conversation at all.
Right.
And so those are good conversations and debates to have, but I think that what are we supposed to do about our current immigration situation? I think we care for immigrants the best we can, the ones that God gives to this place in our community. Let's go to the next one. We move from immigration a bit to more just societal violence. I mean, man, it's hard to turn on the news at any given day and not see something bad that happened to somebody. And so somebody asked, what can we do as a body to address and help stop violence in our society? How do we get rid of all the violence in our society?
And we as a body, you know, aren't going to be able to do that much for a nation of 300 million, etc. But there is an aspect to which we as individuals can confront our relationship with violence.
Yeah.
So, like, how are we being formed to think about violence? So when we turn on the news, what is our response? A mentor that I had one time basically said, whenever you encounter something like violence, like if you see an ambulance going by, is your reaction to pray for that person? And it's like, that was a way that we practiced for a little while of every time I saw an ambulance, I would pray that God would take care of them, that he would be with the doctors that were going to be involved. And just thinking about, like, my disposition towards violence should be one of desiring healing, desiring help. But then, you know, it kind of looks at, like, what is the media that we're consuming? Like, Paul says that there's a lot of freedom we have as Christians and we should respond how we're convicted. But if you take an inventory of what you consume, how are you consuming the violence that you may or may not see? So, like, it's not to say that you can never look at violence, but what is actually happening to you? Just pay attention to that, because there might be a time in which you should disengage with a particular piece of media because it is forming you in a particular way.
Yeah, that is, you are preaching my sermon there, Brett. Oh my goodness. Like, stepmom, I didn't feel like I had a lot of, say in my house about what my teenage kids, watched on TV. And it was so irritating to me. And I had a very immature, just angry response to it, which was totally unhelpful. But I knew that my kids were, their souls were being shaped by what they were watching. And I have a strong, strong, deep conviction that we should not celebrate depravity as entertainment.
Yeah.
And we should realize that what we take in through our eyes deeply impacts and forms our soul. Like, we often talk about, you know, discipleship as being transformation because we are formed. Everything around us is indeed forming us. There's a quote by Arthur Jones that I really like. It's, every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. We are getting the results in our society.
You know, that question, like, why is it like this? Because this is the system we have.
Right. Yeah, if you take in this much violence by TV and video games, guess what we're going to become? We're going to become violent.
Yeah, I mean, it's Colossians 3. You know, it's now that we have a new identity and a new foundation in Christ, now that God has given us a new heart and a new spirit, set your mind on those things, on the things above, things that are good and pure and holy and right.
Yeah.
And then watch how we're formed in that. I mean, you know, this question is difficult because how do we as a body, a small, you know, body in, you know, medium-sized body in Flower Mound, Double Oak, Texas, stop societal violence? I mean, in one way, the easy answer is we can't, good luck. But the other way that I think is a better answer, and this is what I think the scripture does. The scripture teaches us that God transforms societies through transformed individuals. God transforms our culture at large through individual change. So it's not that God transforms a society and then it trickles down to the people. I think the nature of the gospel is completely different than that. That's what you saw in the Roman world in the first century. When individuals changed an entire society, there's a really good book called The Rise of Christianity by, Brittany knows by, I'm going to forget the name of the guy. I think Pennington, I forget, but basically, he asked the question, how can you take an uprising of a few hundred people and in 300 years make this worldview the predominant worldview of the entire world? That does not happen. There's, I think, five factors he talks about, and one is definitely it's miraculous. But the other is because these people were so committed to what they believed in that it changed the world around them. So what can we do to help stop violence? I think we look inwardly and say, how am I as a Image bearer of Christ. How am I as an ambassador for the gospel promoting peace in all that I do? How am I being a peacemaker in everywhere that I go? How am I recapturing and recalibrating my world around peace in every relationship I have? So I think I'd start by saying, you know, how do you solve big, big, big problems? You do the next right thing. And the next right thing is to say, how am I being a person of peace wherever I go, whenever I can? So I think that's where we got to start as a church. Next question is kind of around the same idea of violence. Mm-hmm. What does the Bible say about gun control? Lots of guns in the scriptures. What does the Bible say about gun control? How can we keep our rights, yet make this world a safer place for kids to grow up and not be afraid to go to school? That last part. Like, I just put it together. How can kids not be afraid? The kids are afraid to go to school now sometimes. That's really scary to me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what does the Bible say about gun control? Let's start there.
It says nothing about gun control because there weren't guns back then. But it does say that, you know, the government has a right to make policies that would protect people, mm-hmm. right? And so we go back to what we've already said of like, what is the wisest policy? There's going to be different sides that are seeking good, but they're trying to come at it different ways because they're valuing some different things and at the same time are wanting the best for our country.
Yeah. Yeah. You said it well. I think that, it doesn't really talk about policy, but it does say that the government has the right to set policy. And we can have conversations about what that looks like. But yeah, it doesn't talk about guns. Because gun control, to me, is an outworking of the fallenness of humanity as a whole. I think that guns can do a lot of damage, and there's a lot of wisdom around some gun control, either that we already have or need to have. But at the same time, I mean, if you take away the guns, we still got bats and knives and bombs. I don't think you get rid of violence just because you get rid of guns. Now, again, that's not to say there's not wisdom around who can buy guns, when, where, how often. But I do think, the real heart of the issue is about gun control, but it's also about the idea that we're a violent people and we are an evil people sometimes and that we're a hateful people. And how does the Bible address that? Would be an interesting question to have culturally and societally. Like, how are we being formed around those things?
Yeah. Well, you said that, you were kind of surprised by being afraid to go to school. I wasn't afraid when I was in elementary school, but by the time I got to high school, I was actually afraid. And I did sit in my car until the bell would ring. I did stay with my teacher for as long as possible between classes, because there was a great deal of racial violence in my school. And I think I would say two things about that. The reality is our kids are safer than they ever have been. It is true.
Yeah, I mean, like, most numbers, they point that out, that kids today are safer than they've ever been before. More kids live longer than have ever been before. There's less abduction. There's less, violence to kids, really 4 to 14. Yeah, that's a good
point. And then, but you also have to hold in there, you have to hold simultaneously the fact that we hear more about violence that is going on around us and it makes us afraid. And so I think, the Bible tells us constantly to not be afraid, right? Even the evil around us is no different now than it was then, right? They were still faced with terrible things. But, when we put our total trust in the Lord, we know that terrible things can happen. And they do happen. But the Lord is going to be right there with us. And the thing that we give to our children is to hear their fear.
Yeah.
And to say, but God is with you.
That's right.
And teach them that the Lord is their strength. He is their security and their safety. It's not in, can I make certain that no one will ever have a gun near me?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really important. As you're talking about it, I'm thinking about the nature of the question. And to me, there's almost two answers. So how can we make this world a safer place to kids grow up and not be afraid to go to school? I think the rational answer there is what you said, that I can give you a list of how kids are safer now than they ever have been before. I can break it down to numbers. I mean, you said you guys read that book in Moms Together, Free Range Kids, mm-hmm. That just talks about that. If you actually look at it, it's actually a really safe world for your kids. But we feel like it's a less safe world because, to get back to it, when you turn on the news, you see awful, awful things. And it goes back to, what are you filling your mind with? Is it true? Is it not true? Does it take you to a place of fear? Does it not? I'll go back to a lot of the... Is it a Calvin quote, maybe? Luther, who said, he talks about temptation, but it kind of pertains. You can't stop the birds from flying over your head, but you can stop them from making a nest in your hair.
this idea that I can't stop, I can see violent things, but I can not camp out on it for a while and let it run my life. And it's easier said than done. So one side is you have a question about the fear of your kids, and I can rationally show you that maybe that fear is founded or unfounded. It's the church shooting example I've used before. You know, so there is a church shooting once every year, two, maybe 3 years that we hear about. There are 300,000 or 400,000 churches that meet on a Sunday morning. And so when there's a church shooting, naturally somebody on staff or somebody at the church will come up and say, what are we doing and how are we fighting this? And what if we had more cops? And those are good things. They're well-intended. But I'd say there are 300,000 or 400,000 churches in this country, and there's one or two a year. And the odds of it happening here, while we want to be diligent and while we want to do whatever we can to protect ourselves, let's rationally put this in perspective a little bit. But that doesn't deal with the emotional side of the question, which is I'm afraid. And to that side of the question, we'd say that God is still good. That we'd say that God is with you, that I care for you, and nothing's going to change that or shift that. And so I think both answers are needed. And so then we ask the question, what are we putting in? And how's that determining what's coming out? And, you know, I've said it before through this series, maybe the best thing we can do is turn the news off, like earlier and more often. But when it talks about gun control or violence or how we deal with that, I think, again, we become people of peace and we pass it on to one another. And I think that's contagious. All right, let's go to the next question. How should the free world, oh, this is a good one, how should the free world handle the Ukraine-Russia war? I had a buddy of mine when this happened, and we were talking about why it like profoundly impacted us. And he said that for the first time in our lives, and I haven't fact-checked it, but it stuck. For the first time in our lives, we saw a sovereign nation be invaded by another nation. Like, you know, people a generation older than me have seen that happen before. I don't think I have. I've seen infighting and maybe I just didn't know about it, but this is a, what we would call a developed nation and, you know, a developed country. And they said, we don't want you to come in. And this other country said, we don't care. We want what you have. And so it felt like bullyish to me in a way that was non-redemptive. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of where the question comes from. Like, how do we deal with that?
Like, for days, my mind was blown because I've never experienced a war in Europe before.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, over and over again, like, how is Russia at war? How did this happen?
Like we said, stop.
It feels like, you know, that's like World War I, World War II, right. Like decades and decades ago, like right. A century ago. How is this in the present? But if you look at this question, it's like, how does the free world respond? It's like, I can't speak for the free world. Free world's really big. But like, how do we as a church, how do we as individuals react? Like, my first go-to is that we respond with care. So like, yeah. Where are there places that are need? And that's something our church has already done, right?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we've given some compassion efforts. You know, one of our missionaries is from Romania, which is right next door, and he's taken several caravans over there and pulled people out and brought food and water and shelter, and we gave specifically to his fund doing that. So, I mean, we're giving any opportunity that we have to, that we know of, yeah.
At the same time, when we think about, you know, wars going on, even though it's super surreal for me, Jesus did say there's going to be wars and rumors of wars and natural disasters and earthquakes, and this is not the sign of the end, right? That until Jesus comes back, there's just going to be bad things that happen. Charlie, you were talking about how we are violent sometimes. That's just in human nature. And until Jesus comes to fix that in every human heart and sanctify us and make us into people totally devoted to peace, there's going to be times when people choose war.
Yeah.
And that's not something that we can really ever stop.
And I think it's hard for me because I want to be in a place where I say that we can fix all the problems. I want to be in a place where I can directly fix all the brokenness in the world. And part of it's me getting older and acknowledging the things that I think I can control grow less and less with each day that passes. And there's a big problem in Ukraine and Russia right now, and people are hurting, and I can do almost nothing to stop it, just practically. And that's hard for me to fathom and understand, because I think we think that we can control more than we actually can. And for me, what this does is it pushes me to a place of gratefulness. I didn't do anything to deserve being born in one of the richest countries in the world with some of the most privileged ever. And a place where I can freely talk about my faith and not worry about being bombed tonight. But here I sit in a free country, incredibly privileged, and the only thing I contribute to is that God is gracious. I think part of my response just personally is recognizing what I can and can't control and just being grateful for what God has given me, and feeling sad that other people don't get that same, you know, opportunity, I guess is the right word as well. So hopefully, how does the free world respond? We say thanks that we're not a part of it. We do whatever we can to help fix it and how we can and where we can. And we're going there a little bit this Sunday's message, but and ultimately trust that God, in the end, God's justice is going to be felt in the ways that it should. And that's a hard thing for us to do sometimes, is to wait. The next question is kind of a different way to go, but kind of the same idea of how do we deal with big issues, but how do we take care of our planet? What does the Bible say about taking care of our planet? Anybody else watch Captain Planet growing up? Is that just me? Come on.
I think I knew it was on TV. I never actually watched it.
See, this is a generational shift. We got Delin over here, who's probably a little on the older side. It was right in my wheelhouse. And this youngster, Britt, over here is like, I don't know what you're talking about. I watched, what did you watch? Anything, or did you?
Dragon Ball Z?
I don't even know what that is. See, this is the problem what we have. I mean, Captain Planet was a big deal growing up to me. The power is yours. Heart, wind, fire, water. Okay, nobody.
Yeah, the captain you know of my it. World was Captain Kangaroo.
Oh my goodness. All right. So anyway, my view around this is shaped, I guess, a little bit by Captain Planet. But how are we supposed to take care of our planet? What does the Bible say about that?
Well, you know, in Genesis, it says that God's going to create man in his image. And then he immediately describes that the responsibilities of humanity is to cultivate the earth, take care of the animals, rule over the animals in a way that is shepherding to them. And so our first job when he created us was take care of the planet. Take care of the natural environment, take care of the animals. And so as time has gone on, you know, sin entered the world and things are super messed up. Still, most people's jobs for most of human history has been cultivating the earth.
Yeah.
Most people have been farmers. This is just kind of ingrained into who we are. And, you know, since the Industrial Revolution and all these different things that we've kind of changed our relationship with the ground, we still, I think, are called to try to take care of it. Right. This is a stewardship issue of we don't want to actively destroy the environment, but the environment is ours to seek income and resources from. Like, God actually goes out of his way after the flood to say, hey, Noah, by the way, you are allowed to kill animals and eat them.
Yeah.
Right? We are allowed to use these resources for our good and our survival and our livelihood. And at the same time, we should try to take care of this place that God gave us.
Yeah.
I love John Mark Comer's book, Garden City. It's so much kind of about what you're talking about how God is cultivating. He gave us all these raw materials to build, and he is not abandoning his creation, but he's still bringing it to completion. In the end, you don't have the Garden of Eden. You have this beautiful garden city. And so, yeah, God does care so much about this world, and we are to care for it. Because it is, it's a part of his design. It's a part of his plan. And it's a good book. You should read it.
It's actually, it's one I haven't read by him, but I thought I'd read them all so I can take his ideas and make them mine and then convince everybody here they're my ideas. They're preachers do. Now, I think that sometimes we forget that the relationship between the physical spaces God gives us and us is very important. So when God made all the things, he said, it's good. He said, it's good. It's good. It's good. And if God says it's good, guess what? It's good. And, you know, I grew up in a Christian world that really emphasized the one day, not the today, that really emphasized they get to go to heaven one day. And everything before that is just kind of like an evil waiting period and everything will burn, right? And I think since then it's swung back a little, recognizing that was a lot of, like, you know, Plato working itself out in our Christian thought, which is everything physical is bad and everything immaterial is good and everything physical is just holding back the goodness of the immaterial. I'd say that a Christian ethic there would push back against that narrative and say God created physical things for good because they are good. And just like people, there's brokenness in that, but we're called to cultivate that and create out of that. And we're called to say that God gave us this opportunity to use this for his glory. And so it's a stewardship issue, but it's what we're created to do. And I think heaven one day will be defined by physical spaces and physical places we're called to cultivate and care for as we reign and rule with God, like was designed in Genesis 1. So we divorce those two things, and I don't think we should as much. So what we do our planet, it matters. It's not the most important thing, but it absolutely matters. And we just, I think sometimes we need to take that back. So.
Yeah, this year I built a little raised garden area on the side of my driveway. And we built this big, beautiful arbor. And I'm working on this sign to go on my arbor. And the sign is going to say, in defiance of the curse, we rehearse the new creation.
I love that. Mm-hmm.
And so the last several years, gardening has just become so important to me as like a spiritual practice, like putting my hands actually in the dirt and watching what is seemingly dead when you plant it. Like I just planted last Sunday mustard green seeds and they're all beginning to sprout now and come up. And So I just to know that God is screaming his redemption through creation.
It's the idea that like the resurrection is all around us. Yeah. If you just look and see it. And I love that. And we're called to champion that and like yell that out too. Like this is resurrection right here when you plant right. something and cultivate it. And yeah, it's good. So everybody go be farmers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, so, I would not make it very long, everybody. I just wouldn't do it.
So on several of these questions, we've kind of named, like, you know, there's the Democrat position, there's the Republican position, there's different sides of these issues. And I feel like an issue that comes up with taking care of the planet is like, what is the ultimate good? Right. So like some people are going to need to use the environment and need to use the resources there for their livelihood.
Sure.
And at the same time, there can be excesses in that. And so some people are really valuing like the ability to use the resources of the environment. Other people are really valuing the protection of and the cutting down of the excesses.
Yeah.
But both people are coming from the perspective that says that creation is good. We are meant to use it. And at the same time, we're supposed to steward and take care of it. And so it's like, again,
those are things we can agree on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our last question today is one that we're all really excited about, just because I think most of us don't really understand fully what the definitions of some of these things are, because, man, you know what? Words are so fluid now, and the definition not just changes, you know, generation to generation. Definitions change different group to group, and so sometimes it's I'll teach a sermon and use a word, and somebody will come up and stop and be like, what do you mean by this word? Now, we talked about it. I used the phrase social justice the other day, and somebody came up and asked me, like, what do you mean by social justice? And I was just like, you know, God's version of good for all of society. You know, it's a, then you got to be careful about the bear traps that you step in a little bit. And this question is that, does Jesus have any teachings, and what are they on equity or DIE, diversity, equity, and inclusion, politics?
Yeah, it's like you just said, like definitions are everything. And what one group, how one group defines justice is totally different in group to group. And I think, you know, any definition that we come up with that does not include Jesus in it, you know, if we have equality that doesn't have Jesus as the foundation of that equality, then we should really stop and question, like, is this actually good equality that this group is defining and how they're using it? Is justice based on Jesus and his kingdom? And if it's not, then we need to really question whether this justice is really the good that God intends.
Yeah, because people can take even good intentioned words and use it to manipulate others.
Right.
And so, you know, if Jesus is not at the center of diversity, because God created diversity, and that's a good thing to reflect how majestic he is, or, you know, inclusion. God includes all people. That's kind of the thing the first church had the hardest time getting over was, wait, that group's allowed to worship Jesus too? And God's like, yeah, surprise. You know, and the idea that all people have opportunity to promote the good that we've talked about, if the gospel's not at the center of those definitions, they can be used to manipulate us in pretty awful ways. And we're kind of seeing that now, I think, culturally and societally. Right. You know, it makes me think about the first time that I had barbecue in Chicago. I think I'd lived there for 2 years. And my first hurdle to get over was that in Chicago and up north in general, barbecue is just anything you cook on a grill. And coming from Texas, I will fight you over it. I know I'm supposed to live peaceably, but that's just injustice to the nth degree. And God is happy with my violence and anger there. And so, you know, I'd be like, wait, he'd go, hey, come over, we're going to have a barbecue. I'd be like, awesome. And then give me a burger. Like, what is this? I'd be like, this is barbecue. And I'd say, this is not barbecue. And so there's this restaurant. It was called Smoke, with a Q-U-E. It should have my first warning, and it opened, and people talked really great about it. They said, oh my gosh, they have ribs, and they have pulled pork, and they have brisket. And I thought, no, they don't. So my buddy and I that I grew up with in Texas, who's at college with me, went to this place called Smoke, and I realized something, that just because you use the same words does not mean it is the same thing at all. And they used the same words, and they had kind of the same concepts, but it was not like the low and slow or an offset smoker, salt, pepper only Texas barbecue that it's known for without sauces and kind of just focusing on the showcasing of the meats. And it's kind of the same thing. You know, so you can use words like justice and diversity and inclusion all day long, but if Jesus is not in those definitions, then it's not nearly as good. And the one thing I'll say that I feel like we've said a lot in this series is that none of those things define you either. You're not defined by the group of people you're in. You're not defined by your skin color or your political affiliation. You're not defined by any of these things. We're defined by what Jesus did for us, because he defines what all these good things are: diversity, equity, inclusion, justice. And so I think as followers of Jesus, we start there. What does Jesus say about him? He says, I'm the fulfillment of those things. You know, it's why a couple of years ago we did a study in Exodus, and then we also did a study a year before that in Leviticus. And then to study Leviticus gives us such a depth of insight in the New Testament, because Jesus basically says all these concepts of like shalom and forgiveness, shalom's peace and forgiveness and goodness that you have, I fulfill. And just remembering that as followers of Jesus, that the ways of Jesus are the fulfillment of the goodness of God that we're supposed to live out each and every day. So when we have conversations about those things, when we define terms, let's start there. Yeah.
Awesome. And that doesn't mean that the people of the world can't pursue a good version of equality or inclusion, but words can be manipulated. Things can be offset. And Jesus is our firm foundation for figuring out what those things are.
He's a lens through which we look, right? Yep. Yeah. All those things. Appreciate you guys joining me on this one. Joy to talk through with you. Again, like we said before, this is a conversation we're inviting people to. We don't have all the answers, but we know that Jesus unites us, and that together as we talk about these things, hopefully we can spread more of the influence of Christ in our world through all these different questions. So thanks, and we will see you next time.